Hey there, I'm Jeremy with Good Beer Matters. First, thank you for listening to the Good Beer Matters podcast, where we explore the craft and culture of beer. Second, I want to see the beer and hospitality industries improve so we can do a better job, make more money, and so guests can have exceptional experiences. Good Beer Matters is dedicated to the pros and enthusiasts in the beer industry because we are the ones who will make it better. To that end, I want to invite you to subscribe to my monthly newsletter where I share perspectives on beer, styles, pairing, and some practical beer education. Go to goodbeermatters.net to subscribe. My name is Jeremy, and this is Good Beer Matters.
The idiosyncrasies of brewing in an 18th century brewery are something else. Essentially, every country house would have had its own brew house. What more could you ask if you want to sort of sit down and relax and enjoy your surroundings and be taken away?
Do you ever wonder what beer 100 years ago tasted like? What if you lived in an old Scottish castle and discovered a long-lost brewery on the premise? As far-fetched as this sounds, my next guest is here to share this experience and the blast from the past she produces for the rest of us. We find great experiences at the intersection of craft and culture. These are the stories of us, of great food and the beer that brings it all together. For the craft and culture of beer, this is episode 133 of Good Beer Matters with Catherine Maxwell Stewart, the 21st Lady of Traquair House.
Well, I'm really excited about this particular episode, Catherine, partly because before I introduce you or ask you to introduce yourself, I want to share a little story with you. Throughout my career in beer, I've had, maybe a dozen occurrences where I taste just one sip of that glorious liquid and the clouds part and the angels sing, and I have a moment that will forever remain on my highlight reel. And one of those moments was probably 7-8 years ago. I was in Seattle. I had this great little Airbnb overlooking the Elliott Bay as the sun was kind of dropping behind the horizon. And I had gotten a hold of some Beecher's flagship cheese, which is similar to Comté, some prosciutto, some Marcona almonds, and I had your Jacobite house ale, and that forever indelibly seared itself into my memory banks as like, this beer is special. And I've been trying to recreate that experience ever since, and it's hard, but I just love your beer so much. I love the story so much. I am so excited that you're here on the podcast telling the rest of everyone else the story as well.
Great. Well, pleased to be here too.
Will you please introduce yourself for those who are listening or watching, and just kind of share a little bit about you and your beer background?
Yeah, well, I'm Catherine Maxwell Stewart. I'm currently what they call the 21st Lady of Traquair. So I live in an extraordinary house, stroke castle in Scotland, which is over 900 years old, and it has a brew house. And it was originally a brewery that was for domestic use only, used for about 150 years, and then basically lay idle for over 120, 30 years until my father rediscovered it in the early 1960s and started brewing again. So we are brewing very traditional Scottish ales, and they are very, very special.
Well, did the entire house kind of go without use, or just the brewery? Because I believe I read where you discovered the brewery and like, hey, we should put this to use.
Well, it was really interesting because essentially every country house would have had its own brew house. Beer was obviously the safest drink that you could have because the water had all been boiled. So previous to brewing in the brew house, they would have brewed in the kitchens of the house. We have really early 18th century records and before that, and they were evidently sort of paying the servants partly in beer as well. So it sort of doubled up in how who their audience was, who the beer drinkers were then. So in the early 1700s, they built, well, in fact, it was 1694, they built the two wings onto the house. And on the bottom of the wing was a proper brew house. And it was quite a big, it was a four-barrel brew plant, which was a reasonable-sized brew house for a domestic premises. And maybe this is why they were paying all the servants in beer. And they brewed. We know we have things like we have the receipt for the copper, which was in 1738.
Wow.
So, you know, I mean, just extraordinary, really. And we think they brewed really up until the early 1800s, which is, of course, when they introduced beer duty. And so domestic brewing stopped pretty quick after that.
Was that simply just because of taxes? So, you know.
Absolutely. Wow. Yeah. At the same time as they introduced taxes, also you would have got all the larger commercial breweries were being founded at that point. So it just was not, you know, economic to brew anymore. So we think at that point the brewery was just disused. So most old domestic brew houses, they would have just changed the use, changed back into a stable, some other use. For some reason, we're not quite sure why, they just used the brew house at Traquair as the family junk room. And so they basically tossed in all their old furniture, old beer bottles, any kind of junk they couldn't find anywhere else to put. And over the years, it just sort of mounted up. And then they sort of forgot that it was a brew house. And we know this because actually that copper, which was bought in 1738, had they known that still existed during the war, it would have been taken out and used for munitions. So it literally was forgotten about. Right up until the early 1960s, when my father and mother moved up here and they were kind of opening the house to the public for the first time properly. So my dad, who had had a background actually in whiskey distilling, he was kind of poking around all the old outhouses. And I think he sort of peered into the brew house and thought, oh, what's that? I think I recognize that. And that's a, you know, an oak vessel underneath. And so, yeah, he decided to clear it all out. So between him and actually my uncle spent a few months basically clearing everything. And what was so extraordinary was that underneath all the junk, it was literally left. So not only were all the vessels there, but all the original stirring paddles, original lids to the vessels. I mean, some obviously were in pretty poor condition, sure. But basically they worked out that they could brew in the original brew house using the original equipment and the original vessels, which was remarkable. And of course, they had to try that.
Well, in doing research, I discovered this, you know, wonderful old video, black and white video that kind of showed that, yeah. you know, of course, you were in it. I found it remarkable how much your younger self looks just like your daughter in the picture of on the website. It's just like, wow, that's the same person. I thought it extraordinary that, you know, they're showing that, you know, we're using the same mash paddles they had from way back when. And I'm just, you know, I'm boggled that the wood didn't deteriorate beyond use at that point. But what a wonderful legacy to kind of keep the, for lack of a better word, the terroir of that particular brewery.
I have to confess that actually now we do have new stirrers, so they are they are copies of the original stirrers, because those stirrers they certainly did eventually suffer. Sure. but the remarkable thing that have survived is the old oak fermenting tuns, and of course that really is the sort of the secret of the very unique flavors of our beer. Yeah. I think we're the only brewery left in the UK that is brewing our total production in oak.
Well, I would say you got a couple hundred years worth of use out of those mash paddles. I think that's a great investment. Time to move on for the next couple hundred years, hope. There's also something else I just wanted to clarify as well, too, part of the story of your family. There was a story on the website that alluded to kind of a royal background, but I wasn't very clear on that. Would you shed some light on that?
So we are Stuarts. My family name is, well, it's now Maxwell Stuart, but originally the family who were in Traquair House were the Stuarts. And my lineage to 10, it sort of goes back to the first Laird of Traquair, who was a half uncle of the king. So we have this sort of semi-royal lineage at Traquair. They were very strong supporters of the Stuart monarchy as well, right through the Civil War, always retained their loyalty to the Stuarts. So we have a, and also the other thing is that Traquair was a royal hunting lodge. Mm-hmm. So we say that 27 Scottish kings and queens stayed here, which we evidence by charters that were issued when they were staying overnight here. So they go back to 1107.
Well, it's just what an incredible history, what an incredible story that, it, you know, you're still writing, but you have, you know, so many pages and chapters ahead of you that that is just, you know, it's fascinating. I mean, you know, I'm American, you know, if we have something that's a few hundred years old, that's like, wow, that's ancient, you know, and so it's a completely, it's a completely different concept for us. But let's talk more about the brewery. You know, so first of all, I have to admit, and I apologize emphatically, and I'm going to say it on air, I have been mispronouncing Traquair for years. Even recently, with my other podcast with my partner Julia Hurst talking about Scottish ales and wee heavies, I proudly showed your beer as a great example of it, but I mispronounced it, and I'm so sorry. But
don't worry, I don't think you're the only person.
that's like, you know, we're always learning something. So I'm going to learn and move on with that. Besides having incredible beer, which we'll talk about in just a minute, but just the story of Traquair House goes back, I think you mentioned or on the website, 900 years, almost 1,000 years.
Yeah.
But it wasn't brewing for that long though, correct?
Well, no, but as I was saying before, beer was really the healthiest drink.
Yeah.
And so I think they were certainly brewing in the kitchens. We say it's quite possible that when Mary Queen of Scots visited in 1566, that she was given beer. I'm sure she was, and I'm sure that beer would have been produced in the kitchen. So, yeah, we do think that this was probably a good 500-year history of brewing at Traquair. And of course, at that time as well, they were brewing quite a lot of small beer, so beer without hops, so quite a weak version of a beer as well. So you know, it was obviously quite low alcohol,
like the sports drink of that day and age.
Yeah, I mean, what we also found out was that hops was grown in Scotland in the 18th century, in the mid 18th century, which is fascinating because I mean now it's obviously, well, actually, weirdly, with climate change, it is getting a little bit drier and warmer again this year. But actually, you know, in the mid-18th century, they did have a dry, warm, climatic period. And so they were beginning to start using hops in Scottish ales then.
That's interesting to know. I figured you were too far north to actually be able to grow some of those hops. But so they existed at least in one point in time.
Yeah. So we don't obviously know exactly what they were brewing. I mean, we don't have too many recipes from that period. So the beers that we produced, so when they came up with to go back to the very early brews of Traquair, when my father had kind of cleaned out the brew house, he then looked up a friend who owned Belhaven Brewery in Dunbar, which is about an hour and a half from us, you may know that, who was a wonderful guy called Sandy Hunter, who brought that brewery really back to being a major Scottish independent brewery at the time. And so he was obviously very excited. They'd actually also, you know, not too long after that, they actually started a brewing degree at Heriot Watt University, just outside Edinburgh University. So we were in touch with them as well. But in those early days, so this is like 65, the first thing that my father had to do was to apply for a domestic brewing license. And I think that completely confused the customs officers at the time, because I don't think anyone had applied for a domestic license, you know, since the sort of probably the 18th century when they didn't have them. So yeah, so that took some sort of persuading, and then in developing the recipe, they decided to look at a traditional Scottish ale, which basically in Scotland was known as a wee heavy, that was very popular in the 1950s, traditionally drunk with a whiskey chaser, dark, heavy ales.
And not light in alcohol to begin with.
No, exactly. So a strong dark beer, but you didn't drink that much. You drank it in half pints. And so this is what they decided to sort of basically use a recipe that was going to emulate that type of beer. The other reason for making a very strong beer then, and potentially was the original reason, is because we are fermenting in oak, we're obviously prone and vulnerable to infection. Mm-hmm. So we always brew strong beers for that reason. We couldn't brew a lager in our brewery.
Well, and that answers one of my future questions of have you guys considered brewing, you know, trying to keep up with modern times and the craft beer and like, oh, let's brew a lager, let's brew an IPA, mm-hmm. just mm-hmm. to concede to the modern palate. I take it the answer would be no.
Hey there, it's me, Jeremy again. I forgot to mention that I also have a podcast with my dear friend, the incredible Julia Herz. Together, we've created the Sense of Beer Style podcast. It's the essential training for those who want to lead in food and beverage. We've created prepisodes to cover foundational beer knowledge, as well as Stylecast to walk you through each category of the 2021 BJCP Beer Style Guidelines. If you work with beer as part of your job, then subscribe and listen so you can become an authority. Go to senseofbeerstyle.com to subscribe.
Well, it's just almost impossible for us to do. So, the lightest we've got down to is 4.5%, which we do as a nice, it's a nice refreshing draft ale that we do, Stuart Ale, which is our sort of summer draft mm-hmm. ale. I mean, it's very nice beer, but to me, to really have the depth of flavour and the complexity of flavour that you get with the stronger ales, we can't really achieve that with the lighter ales. They're not basically quite as unique. Sure. So, yeah, my preference is probably to stay with the stronger beers. That's what we're known for, and that's what definitely comes out best. The stronger they go, the better they are.
Well, I love that idea too, where it's, you know, like beginning of dinner, you know, it's somewhere else in Europe, they might have champagne as a aperitif, you know, and so having a lighter ale to just prime the pump for our palate, so to speak, to get ready for dinner. But when it comes to eating a meal, I want something that's just delicious and is just amazing with the food as well. So that's where, you know, I've already said on this podcast, that's where your house ale just did all sorts of good for me. So you mentioned that you have, your process, the way that you brew the beers, you're still using this equipment from the late 1700s, if I remember correctly. Yeah. Walk us through your brewing process. I mean, how is it unique from like just the ordinary average brewing process that other people would use?
It just takes a lot longer because obviously in wood, everything just takes a lot longer. So, I always say to people in the brew house that actually you can really see how beer is brewed because all the vessels are completely open. So there's nothing that takes place in a closed, unseen pot. But the cooler, which is open, just has a wooden lid so you can peer in and see what's going on. So the brewing process, it starts off in the mash tun. Mm-hmm. So the malt is basically mashed, but it's an open mash tun, and this is where the wooden stirrers are used, which you might have seen on that very early film. So basically you stir a wonderful sort of porridge with the barley, and then the wort basically drips down into the underback, which is directly underneath the mash tun. And then that is then pumped up into the copper. So the copper is slightly raised above the underback. So originally the copper was wood fired, and you can still see where the wood fire would have gone. And I should have said also that the water used to come direct from a stand pump, and it was a spring water supply. Mm-hmm. I mean, we don't use the hand pump anymore, but we still use a spring water supply. Yeah, which is actually a really soft water, and usually for lot of brewers like a harder water, but anyway, that's what we've got. It works well.
But for your style, it obviously works out really well. But in that old video, it showed that. One is your mash tun wood, or is it copper as well?
Mash tun is wood. The mash tun is wood, but we've now lined the mash tun. The mash tun is wood and still used as wood. The underback we've lined now because the wood floor's beginning to to give way. Once it's pumped up into the copper, we have a 2-hour boil. And then we add the leaf hops at that period. We use all East Kent Golding, so a very old-fashioned variety of hops.
Yeah, beautiful hops.
From the very early 60s, we've never really changed the recipe with the house ale or how we brew. So after the sort of 2 hours of boil, it then is transferred. So again, a really interesting procedure in the old brewery is that we have these wooden funnels that basically funnel the beer across to the open wooden coolers. Now, we have actually lined these coolers as well more recently, but once the beer is funneled through the across on these wooden funnels, it goes through a sort of sieve, which sieves out the leaf hops. And then in the very early days, we had these two huge flat square coolers that basically just had to wait and for that beer to cool. And the only way in which you could speed up that process were these wonderful metal cooling plates, which all are sort of serrated. It's almost like sieving the beer. So basically you lift and separate the beer and that went on for probably about 4 or 5 hours.
That was shortening the process, right?
Yeah, that was shortening the process. That's kind of what I was doing when I was about 10 years old, which I thought was just really good fun. But my dad, who'd probably been up since about 7 o'clock in the morning brewing and, constantly running up and down to the house and getting all sorts of bits and pieces from the house, it was a real procedure. The early brews probably took 12 hours. And then finally, when the beer was, to achieve the correct temperature, you could then transfer it into the oak tuns, which in fact are next door. So that is also a procedure in itself. And of course, having achieved this early domestic brewing license, the customs officer felt the need to come and visit every time we brewed the beer because he was very keen to take the original gravity. And that's how they did it. They basically went to, all breweries. And I mean, you kind of think the time involved in that now. So he was quite often hanging around at 11 o'clock at night. So sometimes he'd be helping finish off the beer, finish off the cooling.
I would imagine he became a family friend.
But I bumped into him not that long ago. He was recalling these early days. So that went on really. And my dad only really brewed about maybe 3 or 4 times a year. So we do have these wonderful early bottles, which are all numbered because he used to also number not only the brew number, but also the bottle number. So these beers obviously now are complete collector's items and they come up for sale now and again. And actually somebody did tell me they tried a bottle from the 70s and it was still basically fine.
Well, I would imagine a beer like that would actually keep. I mean, from the 70s now. Okay, so I come from the 70s and I consider myself well aged, but I don't think I can hold up quite that good. I don't think a beer would hold up that well either.
No, I mean, really what seems to happen with our beers is after about 5 or 6 years, the sediment will drop to the bottom. So you just have to decant them carefully like you would decant a fine wine.
Or a fine lambic, have you done anything to modernize your brewery or make it just more efficient and bring those 12-hour days down to something more reasonable?
Yes, no, we certainly have. And so basically, the story of the brewery really was that in between the sort of when my dad was doing all the brewing, it took probably about 20 years before actually anybody was really that interested in proper beer again. So, we had just gone through a whole lager revolution in Scotland in the 60s. So it took quite a long time for that to sort of that cycle to sort of come back. And we had to wait for the Campaign for Real Ale to get going in the UK before actually there was a real interest. So, you know, it wasn't really till the mid 80s that actually the demand was outstripping the supply. And my father sadly died in 1990, which was when I came back. And it was evident that we were going to need to sort of double our production to make the whole thing even viable to continue brewing. So we have built a new microbrewery next to the old brewery, but we continue to ferment the whole production in the oak tuns. So we consider the oak tuns the critical part of the process because it's fermented for 5 days. And I think that's where you imbue the flavour. It doesn't matter quite so much about the where the beer is mashed in. So we have a little modern brewery, and then we have a wonderful pipe that comes through a sort of 6 foot thick wall and siphons all the beer back into the oak tun. So the majority of our brewing now happens in the new brewery, and then we brew 3 or 4 times a year in the old brewery. But obviously, as I've explained, that is a very long brewing brewing day, so it was never really ever going to be that viable.
So are you just brewing special ales out of the old brewery for like a special release now?
It doesn't. I mean, to be honest, the beers that come out of that really old brew house, that first part, they don't taste any different from the beer that comes out of the microbrewery, because it's really the fermentation. Sure, yeah. As long as the fermentation continues to be in the original oak vessels, that really is the critical part of where the flavor.
Well, you mentioned you only brew a few times a year. Is that I would imagine you're brewing on a daily or close to
we
that?
Brew,
yeah.
Yes. No. So we brew twice a week. So we can. The other issue, which still makes it extremely labor intensive, is that it takes an entire day between each brew to sterilize these oak vessels. So, you know, we can't use chemicals on them. So everything is steam cleaned. People are in there scrubbing away to clean those vessels by hand. So, yeah, it is. It's extremely labor intensive.
Well, and hopefully the laborers are getting paid on top of still working for beer like they used to do in the old days. But, you know.
Yeah. We have two. Well, I know we have two full-time brewers now. We had a brewer who was with us. Our brewers have all come from the estate. So they've basically traditionally started off as grounds people in the grounds. So they didn't come from a brewing background, and was originally Ian Cameron, who was our head brewer. He was here for 40 years. He brewed for 40 years. He had an apprentice, Frank, who basically, he's sort of the same age as me, basically. He started as a sort of a youth opportunity scheme when he was 17, and he's still here.
Wow.
So he's been here for 40 years as well.
Wow.
So we have had a very good, long, steady consistency of brewers at Traquair. And actually, that's quite important, because the idiosyncrasies of brewing in an 18th century brewery are something else. So it takes several years before anyone is allowed to brew beer. It's not something walk into and take it over.
I can imagine. And for my benefit, a lover and consumer of your beer, it's like, you know, let's keep that train rolling as long as we can. One thing you mentioned, how it took about 20 years for this beer to really take hold. And I think about how difficult it must have been for your father to keep the faith, to kind of believe in this vision of this beer will become something extraordinary someday when people finally get it. How did you all manage to be patient for 2 decades before it hit?
Well, I think he really loved brewing. I mean, he really enjoyed the whole process, and it was almost a hobby for him as well. So it wasn't, you know, he wasn't relying on the income from it, but he just enjoyed it a lot. And of course, the other thing where he was very clever was he always sort of pretended he was a big brewer. So he would go off to the international brewers conferences. I mean, he had made friends all over the world with some of the larger brewers, some of the early adopters of more interesting styles of beer. So he was right in there, you know, and I think gradually people kind of thought this is an amazing story. And, you know, it wasn't just a sort of oddity, but that we were actually able to brew, but actually also the beer that was coming out of our brew house was really very, very special beer. So I think it was really from the sheer love of it that he kept going.
That's wonderful. So speaking of the beer, will you, tell us about your beer and if as best you can, or I'm sure you've tasted every one 100 billion times, but tell us about the beer and will you describe it as well?
Yeah, so the house ale that we were talking about before from 1965, so that is a 7.2% alcohol beer. As I was saying, very strong, malty, rich beer, and not very much has changed with that beer. It may just be a little bit more consistent than it was in the early days, so it goes through a much, much stronger quality control process. Because we have the other unique thing about Traquair, the Traquair house and the Jacobite, is they have a 10-year shelf life. So there's not any other beers that I'm aware of that have a BBE of 10 years in advance. We obviously export quite a bit to the States, so we have to be very careful that that beer is absolutely is the consistency is there. So that is the sort of, I think that's our sort of hallmark beer. And then in the mid-90s, we produced the Traquair Jacobite Ale, which is the one that you loved. And that is an interesting beer. That is was derived from an 18th century recipe. So we do have a number of recipes in our archives and also published. We have a wonderful book that was published in the 1680s, which is full of really amazing beer recipes. So we adapted this beer recipe that we found, which had a coriander seed infused in the beer. So essentially that's what the Jacobite has. It's got a slightly darker malt. We use a little bit of chocolate malt and crystal malt. And that basically has it's an 8% beer, so it's marginally stronger. It has a really completely different sort of quite distinctive taste to the house ale. So it's I think in some ways it's kind of like a richer, deeper flavor. Some people absolutely love the Jacobite and some people absolutely love the house, but both of those beers, I think in the end it's a subjective opinion, which one prefer.
And it was actually the house ale that I fell in love with, madly in love with, the love affair continues to this day. I think I've had the Jacobite once, and so I need to find it again and taste it. Yeah.
The coriander is also, it's interesting because it's just, as I was saying, it's just the seed that's infused in the boil. So it's infused in the boil for about 2 hours. And what it does to the beer is it just gives it this kind of freshness on the aftertaste. So obviously they use it quite a bit with Belgian beers, but mostly white Belgian beers. So I don't know any other dark beers that use coriander seed like this. And I always wonder whether that freshness is the taste, how they originally used that. Maybe that was to cover up some less nice taste. Yeah.
The beer, who knows? Could be all the above.
Yeah. So it's not a strong coriander flavor. It's just a hint, and it is just interesting. It gives it this just a fresh aftertaste.
Now, according to the website, you know, just doing the research I can, you also have a bear ale and a 160 shilling. Are those year-round beers that you guys also produce?
Well, the bear ale is a 5% beer. That's one you can really only get in the UK. We brewed that because we needed a slightly lighter beer, and that was our traditional, and actually still is our traditional cask ale. So we brew and cask in the winter, and then in the summer we swap over to the Stewart ale, which is a 4.5% beer. But we also bottle the bear ale, and that sells pretty well too. That's more of, it's got sort of a malty IPA type flavour. All our beers are very much about the malt. So we're not really in fashion with craft beers, obviously.
I would disagree. I'm a malt head and I love good, complex, delicious malt. So,
absolutely. Yeah. No, I can tell you. Well, actually, at the moment in Scotland, I think that everyone has got completely obsessed about overhopped beers. But so we have those three we are brewing all year round. The 160 shilling was a real hit, actually, and it's out of production at the moment because, I mean, we're so small that we can only cope brewing three beers basically on a consistent basis. So the 160 shilling is a 9% beer, which is absolutely delicious. Uh-huh. I mean, as I was saying, the stronger the beer, almost the better the flavors. Mm-hmm. So what we do is every several years, which is what my father started doing, is we do a special, and the specials always were a little bit stronger. So between 9% and 10%, he did a lovely beer for my parents' silver wedding anniversary. So he brewed a special beer for that. So we have the 100th brew, the 200th brew, did one for my 21st birthday. So we've continued that tradition. And so we're just about to bring out this summer, actually, the 2000th brew, which will be really good fun. We're looking forward to
that. Now, selfishly, will that make its way to the US?
Probably not, because it is in a limited. The other thing about the specials, obviously, is that very, very limited.
Sure.
I think the last special we made it to the States was the 2010 brew, which again was a 10%er that just had wonderful reviews.
Well, if you're taking any votes from people, I'll put my vote to send it to the US because I'll line up to get that.
Okay.
And you know, Catherine, we did kind of talk about this a little bit, or we talked around this question a little, actually quite a bit. But just to kind of bring it all together, what makes your beer so special?
I think I always think it's quite difficult trying to market our beer because we've got so many unique selling points. I never know which one to concentrate on the most. But it is that unique package, I suppose. So it's the sheer heritage and history of the beer. The history of that brew house is amazing to think that is all still working. It's still in working order. The actual fermentation process in those oak tuns is definitely absolutely critical to the uniqueness of the flavor. And the spring water, is very important to all different beers, obviously. And our spring water supply definitely has it with our beers.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's funny, you know, I mean, it's a dark beer. I would expect it, I think about Munich comes to mind when I think about the water profile really did not serve hoppy beers well. So the malty beers turned out great, centuries ago. And so I would assume that without knowing what solutes are in the water, I would assume that, it would make it, a malty beer just flourish there, depending on what you have in there. But obviously it works because your beer is spectacular.
Yeah, no, I know. It's interesting. And it's a very, it's a quite a vulnerable water supply as well. So it was a spring supply up in the hills, which served basically the house and the whole estate. And over the years, they've planted tons of trees on all the land around the spring, which I think has slightly damaged the spring or has taken a lot of the water. So we've had to basically go on to the main supply for everything else, and we just preserve our water supply for the brewery. So the brew house has an exclusive spring water supply. And every year we kind of nervously look at the tag to see if we've still got enough water to brew.
No. Oh no. What an interesting thing. It's like everyone, we're saving the beer. go to the store and get your own water. but I imagine, so by my understanding, you've also converted the Trocoir House to a bed and breakfast or a place where you can stay and inn as well. How long ago did you convert that?
Well, we have had, obviously there's been visitors coming to the house. We're open to the public on a day visitor basis, which it's been open since the early 60s. And then about mid-1990s, we started taking guests on a bed and breakfast basis. So if you're a real beer nut, I think this is definitely the place to come.
Oh, it's on my list.
Obviously. So you have a lovely sort of four-poster bed, a complimentary bottle of beer, of course, and then you can get to just indulge in all sorts of delicious beers and have a really unique stay in a very, very ancient castle. So, yeah, no, it's a special place to stay. We only have three rooms.
So it's quaint and intimate. And do you spend time with the guests or do you kind of let them have their own space?
We're pretty busy now, but I mean, I am always willing to come and say hello to people if they want to, or take them around the brewery, or, you know, because we do have quite a number of guests who come because of the brew house, particularly American guests. We always take time to spend and share the story to people that really appreciate it, because, you know, that's really what it's all about.
Do you ever get tired of telling the story?
No. I think it's interesting, and I have taken 100 million people around the house. I never get tired of taking people around the house. It's such a privilege to live in this building, really, which is essentially, it is real living history. And to share that, I think, is also a privilege and something that I really enjoy doing. So, we'll continue having that real personal involvement. So we're very much a family run business. My son now can also take people around the house. Well, I'm spreading the load.
And I would imagine it's very much a family run business because you're the 21st lady of Traquair. So, yeah. There's a lot of family there. One other thing I saw on the website that I looked into just briefly, I didn't spend a lot of time researching this, but it looked interesting to me. What is Beyond Borders?
Oh, so Beyond Borders is a really, it's a great festival that my husband curates, who's an international diplomat and has worked in a lot of major conflict resolution areas, worked for the UN. And Beyond Borders Festival we have at the end of August, which is part literary, part thought festival in the grounds of Traquair. So you can take part in all sorts of really amazing discussions with some extraordinary participants. We do literary walks, bike rides, all sorts of different activities. There's art exhibitions and music over the weekend as well. So it's a wonderful cultural festival.
And so that's even more than I thought it was. But so you describe it as a cultural literary festival. You also threw in the term conflict resolution to kind of help heal some relational wounds.
Yeah.
But it's also not lost on me that you're doing this on the grounds of Traquair House, where there happens to also be a fantastic brewery. How does beer play into this experience of overcoming some of these issues and enjoying the art and culture?
Well, of course, beer is very much a part of Traquair, very much part of the festival. We brew special beers for our events throughout the year as well. So, I mean, you know, what more could you ask if you want to sort of sit down and relax and enjoy your surroundings and be taken away? I mean, actually, it's quite interesting. We have we run a small fellowship here where we bring women from different conflict zones throughout the world. And when they come to Traquair, actually, I think that they get the sort of the tranquility, the atmosphere, the peace of the place. And it does, I think, sort of imbue something rather wonderful, almost a spiritual quality of being able to relax and enjoy. And of course, beer is very much part of that.
Well, I was going to say, are we talking the place or are we talking the beer?
I think both, you see, they're integrated.
When it comes to creating like we're just talking about, whether it's this festival or just going down the road for a nice meal, how do you create this, how would you create an ideal memorable beer experience?
Well, as I was saying, I mean, very much Traquair is to do with the, you know, is to do with the place. It's to do with the place of production. That's why I've always really been slightly averse to having Traquair under license being brewed somewhere else, because it's very much, to me, it's about knowing that that beer is very authentic. And that surely is a great beer experience when you know that you're drinking something that is truly authentic. The manufacturers and the brewers have put their heart and soul into what you're drinking. And that can be, you know, you can have that experience with a much larger brewery. I think the sort of the story of beer and having good beer and a good experience is knowing what lies behind it and how that beer was made, the ingredients and the quality, and knowing that you have got people there that really passionately care about what they're producing. Yeah.
Well, and let's take that thought a little bit further, because if I were to have a couple of your house ales and start feeling ever so creative and philosophical and warm, one of my beliefs is, whether it's literature or music or art or walking along the woods or something like that, there's, you know, there are different forms of communication. Right now we're using language, and language is our go-to mode of communication, but we can communicate through art, we can communicate through song, and we can communicate through flavor. And if you'll indulge me, if that is true, then given your Traquair house and the beer you're producing, what is it you're trying to communicate? What is it you're trying to tell everyone?
Okay, that's an interesting question. So I think that what we are really trying to communicate to people is a sense of real, authentic flavor, a flavor that derives from the past, so that you can drink our beer knowing that that's pretty much the type of beer that has been drunk for 200 years, or how people would have experienced that beer 200 years ago. So I think you really are sort of almost tasting a little bit of Scottish history. And that really is, I suppose, what we're also trying to communicate.
Sorry, I'm just thinking about the kind of the next idea with that. But if you're trying to communicate that history, if you're trying to communicate that experience of Scottish history and everything else, what should people know? I'm from the U.S. I've never been to Scotland. And the one time I've been to England, I was 11 years old and had my first beer and ordered my first shandy at a bar at 11 years old. It was great. But I know very little about Scotland other than some research, the beer, and what the movies tell us. What should the rest of us who don't know about Traquair and Scotland and Scottish beer, what should we know about it?
Okay, well, it's obviously it's a country of great romance, great history, great stories. I would say with Traquair, you see it on most of our bottles, have a little picture of these famous gates that we've had that were closed since 1745. And that was when Bonnie Prince Charlie came to the house, and the Earl, being a very strong Jacobite, promised that when he gained the support of the Earl promised that he wouldn't open the gates again until a Stuart king returned to the throne. And so essentially things were going very well at the time. They were expecting 3 months later there would be a grand reopening of the gates when Charles sat on the throne. But sadly, of course, he was defeated at the Battle of Culloden. And so we have been waiting ever since for the Stuart king to return. So it's a wonderful kind of romantic story. And you get a lot of this in Scotland. So obviously there's a very strong Jacobite history at Traquair. So the Jacobites were the supporters of the Stuart monarchy, who eventually were defeated. But there's always that sort of what if in Scotland, what if that hadn't happened, you know, what country have turned into. There's this great sort of pride in the Scottish nation as well, which goes back hundreds of years. And obviously with the sort of rise of nationalism again, the Scots really care about their history. And I think that comes over, you know, you can see that in the way that other people perceive Scotland as well. I think it's perceived as a country with enormous history and heritage and a real sense of itself, which you don't always get, I think, with England. But Scotland, my goodness, people know they're Scottish and they're very, very proud of it. So, yeah, I think from the outside, it's I think everybody has a sort of, you know, there's a perception of Scotland, which might be tartan, bagpipes, all the corny side, Braveheart, all of that. But I would say that maybe just go a little bit beneath the surface and there's so much more to discover. And so many, I mean, great authentic stories that they're still carrying on today. Many, many traditions.
Well, it's interesting you say that because I have noticed in the past decade, maybe more, particularly the past decade, you know, it's becoming more and more common here in the United States, where, you know, at least where I live, in the Northwest, and I spent some time in the Southwest too, but I still started to see more people with some descendancy to Scotland and maybe Ireland as well. I didn't stop to ask them, you know, where are you from? What does your kilt mean? But I see a lot more people wearing kilts, at least on special occasions. I see a lot more people honoring their traditions. And I remember growing up in San Diego, there was a building kind of there dedicated for people of Scottish descendancy and everything. But back in my day, we didn't see men wearing kilts. That was weird in America, but now I see a lot more people doing it, and it's less of a stigma. It's more of, oh, they must be Scottish or Irish or whichever they may be. But there is more of that nationalism. There is more like, you know, I'm half British and I'm very proud of that, but I've spent maybe a week in England my entire life, but there's still this, hey, we have history there. So it's interesting that you're seeing that nationalism rise, because I'm also seeing that manifest here in the States.
That is interesting. Yeah.
Well, to kind of start winding this down, I wanted to inform you that tomorrow the world has decided that you get to be the queen of the beer world for a day. Stuart will be on the throne once again tomorrow.
I've been waiting so long.
I know, you've been waiting so long. Finally, they recognize my magnificence. So tomorrow you get to be the queen of the beer world for a day. What would be the first thing you'd change?
The first thing I would change? What I would like is that there was more truth about beer. I would like people to be quite, I think there should be a little bit more honesty in the beer world about how people are manufacturing beer a little bit. I am so much a supporter, obviously, of small independent breweries. I think some of those small independent breweries are not so small anymore. And I think there's possibly a sense where branding has taken over on that sort of original idea of craft beer and the idea of small is beautiful, of a sort of independent brewery. So I'd really like to see that come back and see place and those small breweries really sort of be able to promote themselves as what they are, and not just a sub brand of a much larger brewery. So I'd a little bit more truth telling in the people's beer stories.
Well, Your Majesty, let me ask you a little bit more about that, because I completely agree that, or I feel the same way. I'm a product of parents who owned their own business. It was a small business and it was all about quality and relationship and building a good customer base with what they did. But of course the bigger companies that they competed with, you know, overran them and they had to move on. So I'm in your corner in this, but my question is, why is that important to consumers to understand who's big and who's small? How does that affect the average consumer?
Because I think that's what the bigger brands are also selling. They recognize that this story about being small and craft and caring about your product, that's what consumers want to hear. I just feel that the wool is being pulled over their eyes, because I think you have a lot of big brands who essentially don't have that, but that's what they're marketing. They're marketing those values without actually having the real authenticity that they say they do. So, yeah, I just think this should be a little bit more differentiation between the branding and those branding messages, which is obviously what people want, because that's why they're emulating small breweries, and actually the real small brewers coming out, small brewers brewing great beer and being able to tell their story and for people to know that really is where that beer is coming from.
Yeah, I think it's easy for us to confuse quality and craft with consistency.
That's true. That is true.
I think,
yes.
It's like, hey, this beer is the same as it's been since 1995, and it has actual flavor. So this must be good. It must be craft. Yeah, hey, if you like it, drink it. Yeah. But for those artisans who are creating something special, we could be talking about baking. You get that baker from down the corner who makes this incredible Italian focaccia. That's great, as opposed to going to the store and getting store made focaccia. There's a difference. And so, to your point, I think that's a very wonderful first order on your royal list.
But I have one more just linked to that really as well, is that the other factor I would like to see, or to encourage people, is to try those classic beers again, not to be constantly looking for the new, because I think there's a terrible pressure on all brewers now to keep producing a new beer every 3 months or 6 months. But I would encourage everyone to go back to the classics. Look at what a lot of these beers are really emulating. Look at the originals, where, what you're drinking now, where that came from, and where some of those classic great beers, which are still out there, but slightly overlooked now, to what is fresh and new.
I think that's great as well. I just had this conversation with someone yesterday. I love innovation, and that's great. Let's push the boundaries and see where the boundaries are. But the more we're out trying something new, the more we're abandoning quality for new and something different. And at some point, we need to refine and hone and perfect. At the end of your royal day, you have served the world well, and we're grateful for your service. We're going to send you anywhere on earth to have any meal you want and any beer. Where would you go, and what would you have?
Oh my God, that's so difficult. Well, actually, do you know the one place that I haven't been to, which I have really wanted to go, is Einger Brewery in Germany. I've never been there, but I have met the guys and they've invited me over before. I've never actually got there, so that's where I would go. And also, interestingly, in Bavaria, of course, there is a great tradition of beer being brewed in castles. So we found out that the present Stuart claimant to the Scottish throne has gone back, of course, to the Germans, have gone back to the Bavarians. And this guy, Prince Franz of Bavaria, lives in a castle and he has a brew house in it. So I might pop in there.
Perfect. Just pop in unannounced and, hey, you got a beer? What would you eat?
What would I eat? Well, I'm a vegetarian. So, but what I do love is really, really good cheese. So I think I would, if I was in, if I was there in Germany, I would be researching all their best local cheeses. And I love matching beer to cheese as well, because I do think that is can be a marriage made in heaven.
I completely agree. So another big question is, why does Good Beer matter so much to you?
I think good beer is obviously what we all, I suppose, aspire to, is as a good food producer or a drinks producer. What we want to get down to is that sort of real quality. I think that, you know, if you care about what you're producing, we should all be trying to produce the very, very best that we can. And that takes time. It takes years, and it does take constant experimentation. And I think the actual beyond just sheer pleasure of the moment, you know, yourself, you come back to the things that you really love, and there's a reason for that. So I do think that good beer really matters to having real enjoyment from what we drink.
I love
it. Deep enjoyment.
Well, and that's where I keep on coming back to that house ale, because I had such an amazing experience with it, and I keep on thinking about it. It's been since, 2015 that I first experienced that, and I think about it all the time. And so there's that experience where you just kind of consider the implications of that, and it takes a lifetime to answer that question, and that's where it's just beautiful.
Absolutely.
For anyone who is learning about you for the first time or are wondering where they can find Traquair beer, where could they go to connect?
Our importers in the States are Merchant Duvin, based in Seattle, but basically they distribute nationally. So just check out their website, merchantduvin.com. They have a great map, and they can direct you to where your nearest retailer is or online sales.
What about the rest of the world?
In the UK? Yeah, rest of the world. We export to, Japan, Scandinavia. We sell quite a lot to Sweden. So if you're in Sweden, you'll probably be able to find it fairly easily there. We are back in Europe after some time, post-Brexit. But really anywhere in the world, just if you want to know where you can get it, just contact Traquair Brewery direct, and we can point you in the right direction. We also sell online, and we mail order from here as
and
well.
And what is the website?
Website is Traquair, TRAQUAIR.co.uk, and just go to the brewery section and you'll find the shop there.
Perfect. Kind of last question, and you can share anything that you'd like to share. But again, part of this conversation I had was yesterday is you have this younger generation that is entering into the drinking ecosystem, and of course they're discovering seltzers and ready to drink cocktails in a can or RTDs, and they're just really seeking what's new, what's creative, what's not my father's beer type of experience.
Yeah.
What would you say to them about, as you mentioned, going back to the styles, going back to the classics? What's your advice to new beer drinkers?
I think it's great to experiment. You know, I mean, my children don't all like my beer. I'll be honest, but they haven't really liked beer at all. So I think a lot of the younger generation, even to get them to try beer, is a little bit of a challenge. But I think once you've discovered it and as your tastes develop, I think that actually I see a lot of sort of 25-year-old plus, they're beginning to start really enjoying beers. And at that point, I think if you've established a sort of a general taste for beer, my son's just getting to this point. He's 22. You know, for the first time the other day, he said, actually, you know, your beer's, it's actually really quite good. Yes. He's learning.
Have him come talk to me. I'll set him straight.
exactly. So I think once you've got that slight interest and you do like the basic idea of beer, then go out and experiment. But basically, yeah, try those classics, try the best beers. And there's so much more complexity than wines out there to me. I think there's thousands and thousands of different beers that you can taste in different styles. So, I mean, it is nice to see. I know some of these older styles like stouts are coming back. So, you know, people do eventually come around to returning to some of the old beers. But, try those classics.
Well, I'm so grateful for your time. I'm so grateful to meet you, at least on video. And I'm especially grateful for your beer. Obviously, I've shared that it's actually meant quite a big deal to me as I've gone through my career in beer to try and educate the masses and the professionals and provide this cultural perspective, as well as a nuts and bolts appreciation for where beer comes from and what it can mean to our lives. I'm just really grateful that your beer is one of those on my highlight list that when it comes time, I share it with people because this means something. This good beer matters. And so thank you for coming on to the podcast.
That's a pleasure. Well, come to Scotland one day. We'll show you the brew house in person.
I can't wait. Thank you.
New beer is exciting, and I'm a big proponent of constant improvement. But some things have already been perfected. I believe that when we revisit some of these beers and classic styles from the past, it will give us a better idea of where we ought to go in the future. In the next episode, we head down under with an expert to learn about the flavor and the logic behind Australian beer. I'm on a virtual tour of the craft and culture of beer around the globe. I've put Good Beer Matters on video so I can take you along for the ride. If you know of a person, a place, or a beer story that needs to be told, let me know. Meanwhile, grab a beer, hang out with friends, and let your world open up. Thank you for listening. Cheers.